Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates on today's show. I have a very special guest, a returning guest. His name is Jason Horsley. Last name is spelled H-O-R-S-L-E-Y. He's been on my show many times. He comes to us from, he lives in Spain now, used to be in England, and Canada formerly when we did a couple of shows. He was up in Vancouver area. But today he's written, and you can see this if you're watching this live on X, Rumble, or Rockfin. He's written an article called, let's see, the article is A Violence, Identity Formation, and Maternal Psyche in Nihilistic Dream Worlds for the New Decoding Culture Foundation's first issue magazine. You'll see this coming through. A lot of names, kind of like the people I've talked to about many things. PsyOp Cinema. You'll see Brett Carollo, Stephen DeLay, Jay Dyer, John Stroop, who I don't know much about, Thomas Millery, Jamie Hanshaw, Phil and Daryl Collins. We're going to talk about that next week, this their article as well. So you're going to probably hear more about the Decoding Culture Foundation. But we'll go to this article. And I'll just mention some of the old shows I've done with Jason so people can check it out from my catalog. We've done his book, Seen and Not Seen, Confessions of a Movie Oddist, kind of overlaps with this article. 16 Maps of Hell, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture, and Rough Draft of the Exit. We've done Dark Oasis, The Self-Made Messiah Unveiled, about Guru John DeRuiter, who I think is in jail. He was arrested. I don't know what happened. Also, Vice of Kings. He was arrested after we did that show, actually. Vice of Kings, How Socialism, Occultism, and the Sexual Revolution Engineered a Culture of Abuse. Prisoner of Infinity, UFOs, Social Engineering, Psychology, Fragmentation. And the most recent one we did with Roberta Glass of the True Crime Report was about documentarian Andrew Jarecki and his ambiguous world. Ambiguous indeed. But again, today we're going to talk about this article. Great article. Read through it. Had a lot of thoughts myself. A lot of personal stuff, actually. Things that are interesting. Title of it, again, is Violence, Identity Formation, and the Maternal Psyche in Nihilistic Dream Worlds. And the author, again, is Jason Horsley. So, Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Bill.
For people who may not have heard our other shows, maybe you can just do an overview of your work leading up, how you got involved in the Decoding Culture Foundation, and your new article, please.
Yeah, well, this is a sort of full circle for me, although, as you rightly pointed out, similar to Seen and Not Seen, that was a full circle. I came back 10 years ago in 2014 when I was revisiting The Blood Poets, the first book that I published in 1999. And, well, because Brett and Thomas were doing this magazine, they suggested that I write something, and I just ended up revisiting the introduction of The Blood Poets, material in there about psycho and about cinema and cinematic imagery as a kind of weapon, a psychological weapon. Even though The Blood Poets was essentially a book of film criticism, I was still very much interested in social engineering and mind control and these subjects. I just kind of shoehorned it in, or Trojan horsed it, via a book about cinema. Anyway, so I revisited this material, and I found there was just a lot in there that I still hadn't developed, even in Seen and Not Seen. Like, it's like the gift that keeps on giving, specifically Hitchcock's Psycho and the subtext of that, but more generally violent movies overall, and a specific kind of subset of violent movies, mostly from the 70s, the kind of new Hollywood scene, but also beginning earlier in the 1960s with Psycho. But then I trace it back to Shannon DeLu, for example, Surrealism, and even the very first film, mainstream narrative film, The Great Train Robbery. This theme of imagery that assaults us, which we kind of take for granted now, it says we just consider it entertainment, but it overlaps with so many of my interests, whether or not I'm writing about film, in terms of psychological formation and trauma and conspiracies and social engineering and the arts and culture as a means for manipulation, cultural engineering, and so on. So I just, it just brought a lot of things together. And because of the Decoding Culture Foundation and their interest in this topic and in my own work, I've just found myself revisiting this whole area.
Right. And it's so important because that's kind of the world you grew up in, and me as well. I mean, you're from obviously the UK, still watching a lot of cross-pollination of these films, but really identifying with them, and they become a cultural reference, right? So I think that engineering, this kind of engineering concept that is in your article is very apt, that we're being subjected to this, and you kind of finalize it as kind of like we're the subject, right? And they're the, almost kind of like they're the master psychologist. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, as I say, I keep revisiting this question as to how it is that movie imagery can be used to colonize us psychologically and turn us into kind of avatars of these stories. But each time I get a deeper and I hope subtler understanding of what it is. And one of the things that was becoming more conscious, also 60 Maps of Hell I revisited. So this is about the third time I revisited this material from Blood Poets, which was, and Hitchcock, the reason Hitchcock is such a go-to is not just Psycho, but because he was very conscious and explicit about how he wanted to manipulate the audience. And he was recognized and celebrated as that, as the master of suspense, is the master manipulator. He knew how to play the audience, as he himself put it, like an organ, like an instrument. And so this idea of the film director as a master manipulator, using imagery and light and sound, it overlaps, as I wrote about most explicitly in the last chapter of 60 Maps Hell, with sorcery and the manipulation of perception and awareness. And a sorcery overlaps with possession, like the conjuring of demons and the sending demons to take people over or to control people and so on, however that works. I mean, that's very esoteric. So that's much more difficult to be sure about what's happening there, because it's very much in the realm of invisible. But the overlap with film and the way in which, well, two things I'll mention just to round up this intro. The way in which we ourselves as film goers identify with the main character, that's very obvious, and thereby we're putting ourselves into the shoes of Jack Nicholson or Janet Leigh or Clint Eastwood or whoever it is. We're kind of entering into them as if they were our avatars in the movie, but that's a two-way thing. We're allowing ourselves thereby to be possessed by the image and the characteristics, let's say, of that character slash actor. That's the first thing. And the second thing, which is somewhat more new to me and hopefully to others, is the way in which directors use the films as their own extensions of their own psychic interest and psychic control, and thereby turn us into their avatars, if you will. They create these scenarios and they create characters we identify with. So then they lure us into the scenario. If you think of virtual reality or Second Life or something like this, or what's his name, Zuckerberg's metaverse, which didn't work. And once we're drawn into that, it's like we're using avatars to explore this world, but at a higher level, the directors are turning us into their avatars to imprison us in these fictional realms. So that's metaphorical and somewhat literal, but just as a way to sort of viscerally or imagistically describe how that works and how it is that movie watching really is a kind of being abducted and dragged off into the underworld, you could say, like Persephone, into this fake reality created by filmmakers, and thereby possessed by it. You know, we become the sort of prisoners of it, hostages of it, and then we carry that program into our lives.
Right. No, it's really profound. I mean, it really is a profound, and you say these directors, such like great names, Hitchcock, Polanski, their interpersonal lives are reflected in these films, which are thereby reflected in the audience, because Hitchcock, you see, like, he's wearing drag, and so does Perkins too, and Polanski's, you know, his personal life was, I mean, reflected in his films. It has to be seen that way, whether it's Chinatown or Rosemary's Baby, these women controlled, right? Just kind of like he controlled his women. And it was, I mean, we've talked about that in earlier shows, his predilections. But then they're reflected in the films that we watch, right? So that we're identifying maybe with some of these other characters, whether we like it or not, right?
Yeah. It begins with, I mean, our understanding of this begins just with the auteur theory, the sense that the director is the author of the work, which itself is questionable because, of course, the movie is a massive project that involves dozens, if not hundreds of people and institutions and all the rest of it. And yet somehow it's kind of undeniable that a director leaves his mark on a film, if we're talking about Polanski, Hitchcock, Scorsese, and that's considered benign. I mean, that's just considered the nature of the art. But what I'm looking at here, and I'm looking at it by looking at these particular cases of directors who enter into their films, who play roles. So Hitchcock, well, he just did cameos, but he was a big personality on his Hitchcock Presents TV show. So the cameos were more, you know, people were looking out for them. And it was a kind of wink to the audience that he was the god of that world that they were letting themselves get captured by. So, and then with the example is Polanski, he plays the midget, as Jack Nicholson calls him, in Chinatown, who warns, I was just reading Stephen DeLay's article about this because it overlaps with mine, he warns Nicholson to stay away from this, just stop snooping around, don't be nosy. You know what happens to nosy fellas, they lose their noses. And then Polanski slits open Nicholson's nose. So that's a key scene in the movie, needless to say, because Nicholson wears the bandage for the rest of the movie. That message is really delivered to us, if not to Nicholson, because he carries on Jake Giddies, he carries on investigating, but don't be nosy, don't look into this stuff, you know, it's none of your business. And Polanski, the director, the master behind it, is the one delivering this message. So it's got this double layer, you know, it's much more profoundly meaningful because of it. And as you say, it hints at, and if we look more deeply, we find confirmation that Polanski, if not, I mean, he wasn't obviously like a knife-wielding thug, but we know the Manson family, the murders, the stabbings, him holding a knife has a hell of a lot of weight to it. You know, it's it's charged. So he's drawing upon his personal life to increase the power of the imagery. And then, of course, most people won't know that Nicholson found out around the time of Chinatown, I mean, before it was released, I think, that the woman he thought was his sister was in fact his mother, because she had to pretend to be his sister because she was pregnant so young. So my mother, my sister, that whole scene in Chinatown has this weird significance to Nicholson, the star. Then there's John Huston, who's involved with George Hodel, the Black Dahlia murder and the rapist of his young daughter. So George Hodel is very much like Noah Cross in many ways, the character that Huston plays, who was Huston's friend, and so on. Right? There are all these dark and sinister overlaps, which clearly the people involved would have known about and must have been intentionally including them. You could say, well, they were just drawing on their lives, right, to create. But no, I mean, not when it's that dark and that sinister, then you have to at least speculate that something else is going on, which includes, well, so-called revelation of the method, really. They're telegraphing or they're glamorizing their crimes,
right,
and then winning awards for them. That creates this kind of complicity with the audience, an unconscious level for the audience that is complementary with what I've been talking about, that we become captured by the myths that these sorcerers create.
And it is kind of like a sorcery. Chinatown, for example, I think that the guy was drowned in, wasn't he drowned in the pond and then thrown in the water? So he was moved, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that too. So it's almost like a smiley face killing type death. Yeah. So it's like the personal lives are complicit. And one of the films maybe an American audience wouldn't know much about is Peeping Tom that you mentioned. And can you talk about that and its relevance? That's another one where this director is directly involved in the kind of filming and the implantation of these kind of nihilistic dream world, right?
Yeah, yeah. So Michael Powell, who's best known as the Powell and Pressburg or the Archers, who made these wonderful films in the 40s and 50s, he effectively ended his career, not intentionally, when he made Peeping Tom in 1960. And it's written by Leo Marx, who was a British intelligence officer who later did the voice of the devil for Scorsese in Last Temptation of Christ, as a sort of, not a trivia point, but a sort of footnote. And Scorsese helped to resurrect Michael Powell's career later in life. So Scorsese and Powell were very close because of this. In fact, Powell married Thelma Schoonmaker, Scorsese's editor. So that's how close that little family unit was. Anyway, so Peeping Tom is about a man who is a photographer who was tortured by his father in a sort of B.F. Skinner manner or M.K. Ultra manner, and not because the father was interested in discovering the mechanics of fear, basically the effects of fear on the nervous system, I think it was. And so he would torment his child and film him in states of fear in order to understand more about the effects of fear on his child. And of course the child, and Michael Powell plays the father in the film in the flashbacks. And so of course the son grows up to be deranged, and the way that he acts out his derangement is by kind of reenacting what his father did. He's obsessed with fear, and he murders these women by stabbing them in the throat with the leg of a tripod on which a camera is mounted. So as he's moving the camera towards them, he's also moving the spike of the tripod leg, and there's a mirror on the camera. So it's very complex to actually describe this. It's a bit unwieldy, but as an image, although it's a bizarre image, but it's very clear. It's very easy to communicate what's going on in images. And of course it's very horrific. The killer is both creating his own snuff movies while at the same time forcing the women who know they're being filmed to witness their own terror in the moment of their death, right? So it's just utterly horrific, right, as a scenario. And Michael Powell, who didn't write the script, obviously he saw himself in that, otherwise he wouldn't have played the father. And as I interpret it, was a kind of confession. So I say that Powell is different from the other filmmakers who embraced the nihilistic sadism, let's say, of these films that we're talking about. He was disturbed by it, and he made this film as a kind of confession. At least the way he did it, anyway, it seemed to be the effect, because it wasn't, unlike Psycho, let's say, which is the same year, it wasn't exciting, it wasn't suspenseful, it didn't take you away into a dream world. It was very much just this very grotesque storyline and the obvious thematic meaning of it, which essentially is that film is rape, film is murder, and you as an audience member are complicit with this, which is my thesis, right? So his film basically presented the same thesis that I'm presenting, except that he made it as a movie, and needless to say, the movie was a disaster. Like, the critics hated it, the audiences rejected it, and his career ended there and then. So it's a very interesting case study, because I think what he was doing was he was trying to exercise something from his system, and he did it in this rather foolhardy way by making a film about it. And it's a bit of a tragic irony, because although it destroyed Powell's career effectively, I mean, it wasn't a direct result, but his career did end after that. A generation of filmmakers, De Palma, Scorsese, Polanski, these characters I write about, they embraced the film. They saw it as maybe a bit like a Shenandoah, you know, this kind of avant-garde sadistic violence. They saw it as a blueprint, I think, for the themes they wanted to explore, and then they did it in a much more sophisticated way than Michael Powell. And it didn't destroy their careers, right? They became celebrated as these auteurs of brutality.
Wow, interesting. It reminds me of that scene from a Donald Campbell, the guy who directed Performance with Mick Jagger. He was the white of the eye, and then part of it, he was a serial killer, but he would get the women and drown them and shove a mirror in their face. It's actually kind of a thematic part of their marketing for that film, Why Do the Eyes, really disturbing. And then the eyeball and all that stuff.
Strange Days.
Yes,
very strange. Strange Days as well had that theme. I think it was virtual technology for
filming. Yeah, is that a picture of from Peeping Tom right there? Is that it with the razor?
That is Chien Andalou. That's the Buñuel Dalí film from the 1920s that basically launched the surrealist. I mean, surrealism wasn't in the cinema, so surrealism was still already going, but it transported or imported the surrealist movement into film. That particular film.
I see. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
It's a short film.
It reminds me of the picture of Christofferson with the razor up against his eyeball. He must have gotten it from Buñuel.
He must have done. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I'll send you that picture after the show. But you also go into kind of like these other serial killers, that kid who like shot people up in Santa Barbara, stuff like that.
Rogers.
But they also, one of the interesting things is you mentioned The Collector by Knowles too, like this whole idea of capturing women and this.
John Fowles.
Yeah. Can you talk about that?
So John Fowles is the British author who he came to significant whatever, made his name with prominence, came to prominence with The Collector in 1960, I think. And I remember in my article, I say he would have been writing it at the time that Psycho came out, and he probably saw Psycho. So anyway, it was right at the same time. And it's about a working class guy who abducts a girl and keeps her in his basement in this house that he was able to buy because he won the pools. And he's trying to force her to fall in love with him. But of course, instead, she dies and she hates him the whole time because it doesn't work because he's delusional. But I write about that because of this basic fantasy that a man has, that men have, to have total control over a woman, because it's, well, that's a big subject. But one of the themes of this piece is that maternal enmeshment, when the male psyche is still enmeshed in the mother's psyche, like Norman Bates and Psycho, that man feels under the power of women, particularly women's sexuality or their sexual desirability. He feels like powerless in the face of it, because he can't, unless he becomes a rapist or a Casanova superstud, which isn't usually an option, the second one, then he's powerless in the face of the experience of his own desire. So this fantasy meets that need, right? You capture a woman, you tie her up in the basement, you can have her whenever you want, right? It's a bit different because he wants her to fall in love with him. But, you know, the male psyche that is this way does tend to want to have its cake and eat it. It's not just about sexually dominating the woman. It's like trying to recapture the mother's love or get the mother's love that it never got. And so, yeah, so Fowles wrote this story as a blueprint, I think. It's an archetypal novel. But Fowles also, he wrote The French Lieutenant's Woman and The Magus, very famous work.
Yeah.
And these themes are running through his work. And so he has this thesis about how all novelists are essentially they create fantasy worlds in order to try and recapture their the mother's lost body. Let's just keep it simple, right? Because they had an unhealthy attachment to the mother's body, then they have a longing, right, to have a healthy attachment. They have this unmet longing and need for the mother's body. I mean, I wasn't breastfed, so even something like that could contribute to it. And so his thesis is that all novels, all fantasy creation by men has this theme. And I think, if it doesn't have the theme overtly, it has this unconscious motivation. And I think it's quite credible. I mean, Big Mother is all about this, and the last chapter of 60 Minutes of Hell, if you look at sort of the final goal of here was something like the metaverse, it is about creating surrogate realities, you know, sim theory and all that. And that, as I put it in Big Mother, is about trying to recreate the mother's body and disappear into the mother's psyche to return to the womb. Anyway, so there's a lot of information. I hope people can keep up with all this. But this intersects with male violence. That's why I bring up these the incel type Elliot Rodgers, we can see clearly that it's a bit of a cliche, too much of a cliche, but it's also in Taxi Driver, that the man who's the young man who's socially dysfunctional can't connect to women, so he ends up acting out violently, right? So that's a theme that runs through many of these movies and, of course, through our culture as well.
Yeah, Fowles, I don't know if you know this, but that book, The Collector, influenced Leonard Lake and Richard Ng. I don't know if you've heard about those two guys, but they basically conducted like a serial murder spree in San Francisco for, you know, killed at least 25 people. Or right. Charles Ng, excuse me. But that was their book. And, I mean, he said the same thing. He said, this is what, there's a videotape of Leonard Lake saying, I want to be able to use a woman whenever and however I want. When I'm tired or bored or not interested, I simply want to put her away, lock her up, get her out of my sight, out of my life. So it's like the just that theme that's there of total control is really something else. One of the things that I found interesting was you also mentioned Harold and Maude, which is kind of like an outlier, or is it part of this theme? I mean, it's kind of like a guy trying to find his maternal psyche, right?
Well, I mention it as a contrast because Dirty Harry is my favorite movie, and then I saw Harold and Maude. So Dirty Harry became Harold, totally different characters, of course. But Harold does, he has a mother who oppresses him, and that's why he's acting out these death fantasies. So it is on topic, but not as a as an example of this kind of malevolent or pernicious cinematic use of these themes. I would say that, not to say it's entirely innocent, it's a Hollywood movie, but relatively speaking, it's more about, it's actually showing the psychological paraphilias and pathologies that are being concealed in these other works, and in a comic way, it's a comedy. But yes, he does have sex with his grandmother, so it certainly has some questionable aspects. It's my niece's favorite movie now. It used to be mine.
Yeah. And that was the same. The woman is the woman in Rosemary's Baby, right? Same actress. Yeah. That, by the way, that church is the church I grew up in. St. Thomas Aquinas is where they first meet. That was literally down the street from my house. So people would drive by and take pictures of it because they loved Harold and Maude. So
wait, but you weren't born when it was filmed.
I was born in 68.
Well, you were born then. We're the same age almost. Yeah, because it was filmed in 71.
Yeah. I moved to Palo Alto in 76. So that's where it is. It's on the corner of like Homer and Waverly. So that was, I grew up Catholic. So that was my church. Well, I went to St. Albert's too, but that was the old Palo Alto. But it is interesting. It was just kind of like a fixture in our lives because of the fame of the film.
Really? Well, because it became a cult film.
Like, yeah, it's a cult film, exactly.
It wasn't a success at the time, but an audience is kind of,
There's something about it. There's something like sweet about it, right? Like it's just a pleasant watch. But some of these aren't pleasant. Like, I mean, Travis Bickle, like, well, how does, that's his most famous movie, maybe Goodfellas, but
Raging Bull. I think, Taxi Driver is the film that he made that has had the most influence cinematically and in other ways as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. On me as well. Like, it really had a huge influence on me.
Like, what's the difference? What do you think the difference is in this identity? Because like, people are forming their identity from these films. Is there really a line? Is there is there a distinction? Because it really is. Like maybe in the old days you would read like Pliny's Lives or something in the Roman Empire or something from ancient Greece to kind of learn to be a male identity. But in modern age, you're getting your identity from both people like Callahan and people like Bickle, right?
Yeah. It's an important thing that I talked about in Seen and Not Seen as well, which is that in our minds, we can't really separate the actor who is a movie star from the character. If we love Travis Bickle, we respond to him. It's because it's Robert De Niro, right? Robert De Niro brings his talent, his charisma, his acting genius to that role. And so he makes it come alive for us. And of course, we want to be like a movie star. not just in the fact that, as I've said, the charisma and the talent, but also a movie star is somebody who gets loads of sex and money and everything, and it's the American dream. So that is not often commented on, and it's not conscious. We think we keep them separate. We can admire De Niro's performance, and then we can feel sorry for Travis Bickle. But the thing is, our experience, our response to the movie is just one thing. So see, if we love the movie, if you're like me, we just love the movie, we love De Niro, and then we love Travis Bickle. I basically loved Travis Bickle for years, and I have an army coat that's a match for the one he wore, you know, and I'm in my 50s, right? So that is very insidious. Like, how does that happen? How does that work? And how is it that we don't kind of recognize it? It's a bit of a Trojan horse. Like, Robert De Niro and Taxi Driver is a Trojan horse for the archetype that Travis Bickle is. And this is a much larger thing. Like, the SciUp Cinemas have done this series that you probably talked to them about it on your podcast, about the Joker cycle and Taxi Driver. And it's very interesting. I mean, they're getting into an awful lot of sort of correspondences here that have to do with what you're asking about. How does a young man in today's world develop an identity somewhat consciously by seeking role models? Yes, no, they don't go to my mind's
Chinese going, lives or but, whatever, the classics anymore, right?
Well, figures who have written about what it is to be a man in a way that is serious and deep and thoughtful, and at least they're attempting to guide, right? They don't go to, I guess Jordan Peterson filled that void, right?
Right.
You can certainly question that. So there are these figures, but
maybe Joe Rogan even too.
Well, yeah, extent. I mean, there we go. Okay, so we're getting
like learned. Joe, and he works out, and
exactly
his health pills, and
exactly. So he's but Peterson also, and Peterson is not a good writer. He's a good talker. I read his book. He's nowhere near the level that we're talking about. But still, that would be the closest that young men get in today's world. But the thing is that it's not enough, even if they were any good, which I don't think they are, these figures. The young men who are raised on movies and other kind of pop music, other kind of pop cultural media, they do find, as you put it, role models to help them to strengthen their sense of identity, how to be in the world in these fictional characters, despite the fact, and somewhat because the fact, you think of, you know, teenagers who had posters of Charles Manson on their wall. My sister had Che Guevara on her wall. That's because he was nice looking, I suppose. But anyway, they wouldn't, if, you know, Bernard Goetz, nobody who's kind of a real life Travis Bickle, or Elliot Rodger, who's an example of somebody, whatever movies he saw, I'm sure it wasn't Taxi Driver, but he was trying to emulate these characters, right, by his performance and his, you know, his crimes. Nobody would want to emulate him either. He was a dweeb, right? He was totally repellent. So they need to create these culturally engineered artifacts that very subtly glamorized. Like, nobody would, no critic would say that Taxi Driver glamorizes Travis Bickle, because he's sad and he's lonely and it's seedy and it's sordid. But you can't have a film made by Scorsese with De Niro in the role without glamorizing it, right? You just can't do it. So yes, they become role models. We have lived for 50 or 100 years in a society in which the role models that men are accepting are very often criminals, pathological, sexually, I don't know about dysfunctional, but, you know, aggressive. It can go either way. I mean, Donnie Darko is popping into mind. Donnie Darko seems like a good movie and an all right role model. But, I mean, he was a time-traveling mutant. I don't know what Donnie Darko was. So even there, Harold and Maude would be a benign example, perhaps, because you can see some, except he has sex with his grandmother. So even... Right. Even if you find a relatively benign one, the solutions offered, have sex with a woman in her 80s, obviously is not healthy, right?
Right.
So, but we're at the other extreme now. Tarantino, we could talk about Tarantino. I don't mention in the article. Actually, I'd rather not even think about Tarantino. But he is probably the best example, smoking gun, if you will, of this kind of cultural engineering with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, for example. With, I mean, just moronic, pathological, violent characters, lead characters played by the most beloved movie stars of our time, right? And done by Tarantino, and people, you know, grown men embraced that movie. Critics embraced it. I don't want to get on a rant about Tarantino, but the main point is just the debasement of our values, and specifically our sense of what it is, what it really means to be an upright man, right? How to function as a man in this world. We won't find any positive examples in the movies, I don't think.
Yeah, no. I mean, if you counter it with kind of like the old classics, or Homer's Iliad and these old things, these heroic things, they're not nihilistic. They're creating something. They're fighting for something. But I don't think Bickle's fighting. He's fighting for his ideal of the woman, right? Isn't that what he's shooting, and what his goal is to gain the...
Well, no, I mean, he's so confused. So he clearly has father issues. I mean, this is something I've just been getting into text over again, partly because of Brett Carollo's thesis about it being a psyop, and that Paul Schrader may not have written it from direct experience. But anyway, Paul Schrader's version is that this was autobiographical. He was in this state, not that he ever shot anyone, but just miserably lonely and obsessed with pornography and guns and driving around all night. And eventually he wrote Taxi Driver as the official story, but in the script, eventually Travis just explodes. You know, he falls for a woman he can't have, is how Schrader puts it. And then the woman he can have, who's actually just a child, really, he doesn't want. Not necessarily because he's got morals about that, but just because she's not his type. So he's got this overwhelming sex drive, and he doesn't know what to do with it because of his damaged psyche and his trauma and all the rest of it. So he's not seeking. I mean, he's seeking a release, but he doesn't know what he's doing. Right? He's just acting unconsciously. So, I mean, it doesn't glamorize the character.
Right.
It's just that he's become an archetype. And when an archetype, you know, we talk about the Greeks and Homer and that, whatnot, archetypes, you know, figures who are gods, let's say, or fictional narratives about characters who are divine, that's archetypes. They're supposed to give us models for our behavior, essentially. That's right. What they are. That's what an archetype is. And if we let it possess us, then back to this theme of how movies can possess us, then we just become an instrument of that archetypal force, which I'd say is never a good thing. But at least if it was a god, it might have some benevolent, you know, at least if you want to be a teacher or a philosopher or a healer or there are various archetypal or basic roles that a man can have in life that are benign. But clearly Travis Bickle doesn't count. I mean, even right. Dirty Harry's better than that, because at least there is some potential for doing good as a policeman, perhaps not very much, but some, right? Whereas, yeah, Travis Bickle, he's just basically somebody who uses violence to relieve his sexual tension.
Right. And it's like, well, like one of the Greek mythology, these archetypes and things, like you come out heroically on the other side after defeating somebody from the underworld or something, which are kind of like psychological battles as well. Right. So that's the purpose of the stories. So today's stories don't quite have that. Jason, we are at the 40-minute mark. Is there anything you'd like to add or anything I'd miss? And then can you let people know where they can find this article and your books?
Maybe not. I don't know if you feel we've covered many of the main points anyway.
You yeah. were writing a lot on Substack too, right? Like that's.
Yeah, that's where I'm busy right now. And I was going to mention this, but maybe I shouldn't do this live, but I will. I just put a piece about Peter Lavender, the Crowley Defender, which most of it was just in Vice of Kings, but I thought it was worth resurrecting right now. And I was thinking, oh, we could do a follow-up show about that because, of course, you know, you're well-versed on Crowley and his dark side. And I don't know how familiar you are. I mean, I think you read Vice of Kings. But so Peter Lavender is this character who used to be, if not now, kind of in our same field, right? Conspiracy researcher that was well-respected. But now he's gone over to the dark side with Tom DeLonge and this UFO kind of narrative spinning stuff, I would say. But that more or less coincided with this period that I first confronted Lavender about his advocating Crowley, and he denies it. But anyway,
denied. I have the screenshots. I have the screenshots of him defending it. I've got the emails. I know Lavender knows me personally. I know him, so we can go into that.
If you want to do a follow up, but anyway, that's up at Substack currently. But I post it as this larger question of like in this field that we're both in and. You know, our paths cross quite a lot, even if I don't email you or you don't invite me on the show, because we know the same people, right?
Yeah.
It's worthwhile to do what most people don't do, and I say, which is to start questioning, you know, other characters in this field. Are they trustworthy? I know it's considered bad manners, but, you know, for heaven's sake, if there are operatives amongst us, right, you don't want to be pointing the finger and accusing, but asking difficult questions and so on. That's what I did with Lavender. And it was quite fruitful in the end, I think, because it helped me understand how these characters operate and how it's a bit like the Jarecki thing, but this spinning of narratives and this exploiting of ambiguity that creates, you think about ambiguity, it's the ability to have two ideas at the same time in a way, or to see things from two sides. That's very close to doublethink, and that seems to be central to how certainly to how Lavender seemed to be handling me by saying things like, oh well, in the Book of the Law it's all those passages are in code, right? That's what Crowleyites always do. They say, oh, the bits that are illegal, that's just code, but the legal things, he meant that literally, right? How convenient.
Very convenient, no doubt. Yeah, anyway. No, he's have you ever seen the video of him in the OTO ritual?
Yes, I linked that on my site. Okay. I don't know why he agreed to be on a TV show. He's a funny character. He clearly, my opinion, he wants the sort of mystery of being basically known as an operative, but still having some plausible deniability, and as an occultist, because he also has pretty much denied being an occultist, which is ridiculous.
Ridiculous. I had to block him, man. He really came after me on some of my Crowley posts on X, but I have the screenshot somewhere so we can bring those up. So it's Jason Horsley at the Decoding Culture Foundation. I will put a link to the website. I'll put a link to your Substack. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that John DeRoot is not in jail. He was charged, but that was it. Like so, and then he went off with his followers, or the ones that were left, to this small town to start his, you know, end times compound life.
Oh, wow.
And as far as I know, that's where he's at. And so there is some concern that this could go sort of, you know, I won't say Jonestown because that was a CIA operation, but you know, the way that cults can sometimes go Waco, I suppose. The trial has still not happened. So
okay, so but he's charged, but he's not. He bought land around Fort Assiniboine, or wherever that is in Alberta.
Right. Yeah. So to be continued on that. Like if it ever gets to trial, and if I don't know if it comes topical, then it'd be worth revisiting.
He was charged January 21st, 2023. Charged with sexually assaulting four complainants in separate incidents occurring between 2017 and 2020, so fairly recent.
Yeah, it's a curious case because they all agreed, as far as I know. So the charges coercion. I mean, technically or strictly, they're coercion. That he used his hypnotic powers and his, just the fact that they thought he was God, to make them have sex with him, which I agree is that should be he should be held accountable. I'm just saying that it's a fuzzy area as far as it being assault.
You made his Wikipedia page. Do you know that?
Yeah, I know.
Jason Horsley's 2017 book, Dark Oasis, A Self-Made Messiah Unveiled, examines DeRuiter's life and teachings in critical and skeptical terms with a link. So we got your, they have our discussion. Holy smokes.
Yeah,
they link on Wikipedia to you and me talking about it.
That's right. I remember that. Funny.
I didn't know that. Anyway, discover. Another great talk. Jason Horsley, people check it out. Horsley, Violence, Identity Formation, and the Maternal Psyche. And now listen, Dream World's just published new article on the Decoding Culture Foundation. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, stay there.